accession number 8192, rule number 6.
Brigadier Barclay, reel 6. You were saying that you'd narrowly missed firing on the commanding officer of the Royal Scots.
Yeah, that is so. It was Colonel Money, I remember. And he yelled at me, he said, "What the devil do you think you're up to?" And I said, "We're just recapturing this village, you see." And he said, "What the devil do you want to do that for?" He said, "I was in the middle of having the best meal I've had since the war broke out with the brigadier in charge of the French brigade in that sector. And suddenly the shells started pouring through the roof and brought the electoral meal to Summery Halt." So he said, anyhow, it was beginning to get dark by this time. And he said, "Well, obviously, you'll do far better to stay with me now and until this get things sorted out and with your battalion, and we'll go back and join them in the morning." So I went off my company and joined his battalion for that night, and then went back to my own battalion the following morning. But in fact, of course, the commanding officer was in a very high state of excitement and wrought nervousness, I think, really. Had imagined this thing had happened, and he just worked on his imagination and was convinced that that village had been captured and it was a reserve company's job to retake it.
Did you come across any other cases of this sort of delusion occurring?
Yes, I unfortunately did. It happened once later on in the war, shortly after D-Day, with a brigadier, and we had to have him evacuated like we had to have my commander evacuated by ambulance before he ordered any other ridiculous situations, ridiculous functions to happen. But I met it two or three times, and it's the most difficult thing, I suppose, to really assess how a person is going to react in wartime when you've only got your peacetime experience to work on. I felt particularly sad about this commanding officer, who was a wonderful man. He was a very delightful man. And I'd served under him during peacetime a great deal. And there's no doubt about it that he was about the best peacetime trainer I've ever come across. And he was good because he had a very sensitive mind. And he understood how soldiers reacted. He knew how to get the best out of everybody. We always had the best company. We always used to win all the major events. We were always picked to be guard of honour and this sort of thing. He was a tremendous peacetime soldier, but his sensitiveness and, to a degree, a state of nervousness that went with it couldn't stand up to the rigours of war. And that's all was to it. I mean, I know in the First World War, which he saw a month or two of, he had to be evacuated from supposed shell shock then. And it was the most awful pity that that lesson wasn't learnt, and he was used purely on the training side in the Second World War, because he was a wonderful officer on the training side, and as I say, a very charming gentleman. And that he should have cracked up like he did was a tragedy, and could and should really, I think, have been avoided.
Do you know what happened to him after he'd been evacuated home?
He was given various staff jobs, but he was never the same man again. I mean, he knew that he'd let the side down, and it really worked on his conscience forever. And he died not so long after the war, and I can't help feeling that probably his demise was precipitated by his feelings of sadness.
How was the business of actually persuading him to be evacuated handled?
Well, the adjutant did this. One of the direct effects of his highly high degree of sensitivity, and it was sleeplessness, and he simply couldn't sleep, and he was eventually so worn out. I think the doctor gave him a jolly good sleeping pill and sleeping dose, and without much opposition, they managed to persuade him to go and have a bit more treatment. But I happily didn't have the tricky job of dispatching him.
And who took over?
Our second-in-command took over, Major Charlton, he took over, and we carried on just as before. In actual fact, as one of the records in the war diary states, the company commanders were such a good team and knew each other's form so well, they pretty well knew how to cope with any predictable situation. The commanding officer just had to indicate which plan had to be followed.
That presumably,
and we also had a very good adjutant.
Presumably that was one of the benefits of having been together for so long.
Oh, yes. We trained together in peacetime for at least a year before, and we were all great friends. And as I say, below us, we had good platoon commanders and these splendid soldiers who, they really were crying good lot.
Now, you mentioned your advance upon the village and the fact you had a fire plan coming down on it. When you conducted this advance, what formation were you in?
Well, we leapfrogged forward. I had two platoons forward and one back, and I had each platoon advancing in stages with the other platoon giving it close fire support. And until we got to a position from which we were going to put in the direct assault, which we just arrived at, and at that particular stage, the two leading platoons would go in together.
How far were they?
Oh, we were about 150 yards from the village by then.
And by final assault, do you mean a bayonet charge?
Yes. We were all lined up for this.
And
they couldn't wait to go.
How far had you actually advanced from the start line when you got to this?
Oh, I suppose
final?
The start line was about 1,000 yards away.
And what sort of formation were the platoons in? Were they in arrowhead or lion or?
We were all according to the formation to the ground. If we were going over an absolutely open bit, we were in line. If there were folds in the ground, we'd be in arrowhead or whatever, making use of any fold that there was in the. It's a formation that was most suitable to that fold, to that bit of cover.
How long did it take you to cover this 1,000 yards or so in the advance?
Well, it didn't take too long. I mean, we wanted to gain the maximum advantage possible from the firepower that's coming down. And it was a matter of minutes.
How long did the actual fire last? How long was the bombardment in support of your advance?
Well, I think we had this going for about 10 minutes.
And what sort of guns did you have firing in support?
Well, we had our own field artillery, 25-pounders, and we had our own 3-inch mortars, and we had machine guns from the Manchester Regiment, our machine gun battalion in our corps. And or maybe in our division only, I'm not quite sure about that, but they were our machine gun supporting unit, and we had the lot.
So the village must have been fairly heavily damaged.
Oh, yes, it was. Heavily damaged, most effective and marvellous display of demoralising fire to the unfortunate French brigadier.
How long did it take you to actually set up your coordinated plan for your advance and the firepower that was to support it?
Not long at all. Not long at all. I mean, the reconnaissance initially wasn't difficult because I could see the ground between my position and this village, but I had to brief the platoon commanders on the ground first. And at the same time, I had my gunner representative with the battalion with me, and we evolved a plan, which I then discussed with the adjutant rather than the commanding officer, because the adjutant made more sense. And I suppose the whole thing only took about an hour.
So you got your orders from your commanding officer. You spent an hour planning it, and then the attack started.
Yes, maybe in a bit more than an hour, but not much. And the attack started, and it was an absolute copybook attack. I mean, I commanded a battle school for some time before this, and this was very much part of one of the things we were practicing, not only with just the open country with blank ammunition, but with live ammunition in the training grounds in England where live ammunition could be used. And it was an absolute copybook attack, and I wasn't surprised that it all went according to plan. In fact, all that we had no, as I say, fire opposing us. But
so it must have had some beneficial training effect.
Oh, and the training came into its own in no uncertain manner. I mean, the soldiers did all the right things, and the fire, covering fire that preceded our attack was exactly how and where and why we wanted it. We were armed with 1-in-3 tracer for our machine guns, and this was most effective to see. You saw these tracer bullets tonking in on this village with consummate accuracy. And it was the most exciting and effective attack possible, without any interruption, as I say, until it anticlimaxed and ended it all.
How long did you stay on the Dyle before you had to start falling back?
Oh, that didn't, I think was quite soon after that. I wouldn't think we were there for more than another day. We then pulled back gradually from river line to river line, and withdrawal was the order of the day.
Was it a withdrawal in contact?
No, we never ever carried out a withdrawal in contact. If we thought that was likely, we patrolled very offensively against the enemy positions before we pulled out, and gave them something to think about, and then extricated ourselves without fear of interference. This, in fact, occurred every time. We never once were molested in our withdrawal, which is, I was thankful about, because nearly always I was a rear guard company, and you had a horrible sort of feeling of getting one up the pants as you were coming out. But it never came to that.
Can you remember the route that you took?
Unfortunately, without my map, I can't answer that. And I can remember very little of the positions we took up until we got to the Esco Canal at Tournai.
This withdrawal, was it on foot?
No, it was mostly by bus, and we rendezvoused with our transport at some safe distance back, and were conveyed back to a suitable anti-tank line to our rear, and. And all this, of course, happened under cover of darkness. And sometimes we were taking up positions on virgin territory, so to speak. Other times we took over positions from a unit that had already been in situ and prepared defences.
And you never attacked on one of these prepared defence lines?
No, we never attacked from one of these prepared defence lines until I got wounded. I know I was wounded, in fact, on the Esco Albert Turnout Canal.
Did you actually see anything of the enemy ground forces?
I didn't from the first contact on the Dyle. Until when we were holding this position on the Albert Turnout Canal at Tournai.
Now, what about these patrols? You say you were patrolled offensively. Were they then fighting patrol to disrupt?
Oh, yes. These were fighting patrols designed to keep the enemy at arm's length and or to capture a prisoner. But to deal strongly with any enemy patrols which are trying to get information about our positions, which is the main object of those patrols.
Did you actually capture any prisoners?
No.
Did you find out who was following you up?
No. In fact, when we were moving from river line to river line, we were in the main behind the river line rather than leaving company positions forward in outpost positions, because although we might not have been directly in contact, there was only a matter of hours between their advance and contact with our positions.
How did you arrange to conduct the rear guard action? You say you were usually rear guard company. What did that entail doing?
Well, it entails really being laid out in a same sort of grouping as you would have advance guard going forward in reverse. I had one platoon as a special rear guard platoon with one section in the rear of the main body of the platoon, and platoons separated by quite a distance so that the whole company wouldn't be involved if contact was established by advancing enemy. So that would have time to deploy my company and cope with the situation astride the road.
So it was strung out, was it?
Yes, it was strung out.
What about flank guards? Did you have patrols out on the flanks?
No, because the initial advance of the Germans was bound to be up the road. And our first contact would inevitably be along lines of communication. They were very bad at deploying off roads, in fact, at deploying off main roads. I found this later on, after D-Day, that two or three times I put in an attack down some little tiny side road and avoided all the heavy enemy artillery fire, and in fact achieved remarkable surprise on all those occasions, because they only thought in terms of guarding the main road approaches to their positions.
They're
very inflexible. Mm. Very inflexible.
So you weren't really troubled by the enemy ground forces. What about air attack? Were you subject to that?
Well, it never made a severe impact, our opposition. We were bombed occasionally. We never suffered seriously from air attack. Our drill was very efficient for quickly debussing and scattering. If we were to, I know on one occasion we lost three vehicles, but we didn't lose any chaps because we'd got out of the vehicles and were in the ditches and by the side of the road, and were able to bring fire to bear on the enemy jolly quickly with small arms fire. In fact, I remember one occasion we brought one down, which obviously gave great elation. But one had to have very efficient deployment and scatter drill if there was a threat of aerial bombardment when you were on the road, in transit.
When you were in transit, did you find did you move by day and by night?
Well, nearly always by night, but sometimes one end or other of the day was involved as well.
So the policy then was to lay up during the day in a defensive position and move back at night.
That's right. That's right. And therefore it meant you had to take up your positions at night in the dark. And if you were taking over from another unit, well, there the positions were presumably already reasonably prepared for you. But if they weren't already there, you had to dig in and get the whole thing completed before daylight.
Do you remember seeing any Allied aircraft at all?
Yes. Oh, yes. Not in large numbers, ever. But we saw occasional dogfights. And I must say, our people did remarkably well. They were generally outnumbered, but they nearly always succeeded in bringing, say, one against three, bringing one down.
And what about friendly ground forces? Did you see much of those?
No. We had no... Once we started to pull back during this withdrawal back to Dunkirk, we were never directly in contact with French forces, and certainly not with Belgian forces. I don't think there were any cohesive Belgian forces worth tuppence involved. But had we, of course, held positions for long, we did, we would have certainly been in touch with units on our flank of other brigades or, in fact, other nationalities. But there was never time, because we never hung on to these river lines for long, because the Germans had broken through somewhere to our flanks. It never happened, actually, in our sector. And there was presumably fear on a high level of them turning our flanks. We were compelled to pull back.
Did you know that this was happening at the time? Were you able to keep in touch?
Well, no, because...
The bigger picture.
No, absolutely not. I was a company commander. One's picture was a very limited one, and it may seem sad now that one wasn't more in the better in the bigger picture, knew more what was going on. But quite honestly, we were so involved in our own concerns, our own particular job, that one didn't thirst for the bigger picture. Had we been sitting in defensive positions for any length of time, we'd have wanted to know more about this, no doubt, been briefed about it.
So you're too busy to...
Too busy. Okay. Too busy.
What about the logistics side of things during the withdrawal? Were you able to maintain supplies of ammunition?
Well, no, this was a very, very serious aspect of the whole thing, and a disgraceful one. The small arms ammunition situation was good, but the mortar ammunition was really shocking. We had a 2-inch mortar in East Platoon, and I think we had, at the start of the war, we had 20 rounds of smoke, and I think something like 5 rounds of HE or 10 rounds of HE. I mean, it was simply pathetic. And we never got any more. And you almost had to have written certificate from your commanding officer to fire a round from these little 2-inch mortars, which awkward things to carry. There was a barrel and there was a base plate, and they were heavy and awkward. But the ammunition supply for those completely dried up. And the 3-inch mortar ammunition situation was also serious, not quite so ridiculously serious as the 2-inch mortar ammunition situation, but then again, it was very limited, and there was never enough to complete the job as a mortar officer would have liked to have done.
And what about food and water on the withdrawal?
Well, that was very good indeed. We had a marvellous quartermaster, and we had a most efficient transport officer, and we never seemed to go for long without some sort of a meal. I mean, maybe they couldn't get a hot meal up every night, but there was always food. I mean, the soldiers never ever had empty bellies. It was remarkable how they achieved this. And I mean, sometimes, and I know later on, after I was wounded and evacuated, when the battalion was completely cut off, still the soldiers got fed, and as often as not had a hot meal every evening.
And this is all ration stuff, wasn't it?
Yes, all ration stuff. They did a wonderful job. Wonderful job.
Were you obstructed and delayed on the withdrawal by civilian refugees?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much. It was terrible, this. And further to this, that the Germans used to take delight in machine gunning these lines of refugees. And therefore, there'd be corpses about the place and wounded people about the place wanting to be helped. It was terribly difficult. It really was. That one just had to harden one's heart and get on with the job we had to do. We simply couldn't be held up by... clearing refugees for the road was a very difficult job. Our motorcycle... motorcycle police of the regiment had a frightful job keeping the route clear for transport moving about this. It was a grim aspect of the whole thing and impeded us very much. Mm. We had to have very strict rules about it, but they suffered appallingly.
Now, you mentioned earlier on something about 5th Column activity, breaking the lines to Brussels. Did you see any other signs of 5th Column activity?
Well, I never knew how much to believe. There was an awful lot of talk about it all the time. And there were alarms excursions frequently about German parachutists dropping here, there and everywhere. It was jolly difficult to know what to take with a pinch of salt. And I think a good deal needed to be taken with a pinch of salt. It may well have been that aerial bombing had been responsible for the line between Wavre and Brussels being put out of action. I just don't know. But anything like that that caused disruption was automatically put down to 5th Columnists.
You didn't see any positive evidence?
No, I didn't. But I dare say that our intelligence officer did. But I know he became pretty sceptical about reports he got.
Did you see any leaflets or any other evidence of attempts at psychological warfare by the enemy?
Yes, I did. Oh, yes, they dropped leaflets. I'm just trying to remember where. We had little... snippets from Haw-Haw. Yes, I remember that. We dropped quite a few ourselves, too. I know that, too. But, yes, we did. Twice we had a shower of these things. Once was on the River Dyle, and once, I think, either when we were digging the Gort line near Rumagie, or else when we... I think we were in reserve at Orshie. Yes, we were in reserve at Orshie. I remember now.
What sort of effect did these leaflets
have? Oh, none. No, big joke. Soldiers thought this was a big joke. It proved their morale a lot.
How did their morale hold up under the strain of this endless series of retirements?
Oh, it was remarkable. It really was. One felt terribly proud of the way they reacted. They were positive that they were in good hands. They were positive that... what they were being told to do was in the best interest. And their morale was really remarkable. And they never failed to see a joke in everything and get some kick out of whatever ghastly, awful job they had to do. It was simply amazing. My admiration knew no bounds, I must say.
Were they able to get any sleep on the...
Well, soldiers are marvellous people at getting sort of cat naps. You know, they'll have a cat nap in the strip trench. So they'll.